high it was 95, next was 94.5, so it's very like that, but there were 17 people. So this is a doable exam. It was a doable exam. Somebody get 98%. And I know the academic background of the person, and it's not that the person is coming back to take the course for the second time or anything, that's not the case. And so 80 to 89%, oh, sorry,
from work or whatever,
And if there's something the class can benefit, you know, then it's, you know, it's, I'd like you to just, you know, say to the class, you know, so that it's, you know, can benefit, because a lot of people don't have, you know, such a good experience. And it's here, you know, doesn't feel like getting up because it's been so comfortably. And so, what he had told me the other day was he had seen about 200 or so cases of coris fracture. And in his, you know, he has worked, you know, in the health field. And he has even seen one ulnar fracture that supposedly was, you know, diagnosed as coris fracture, wasn't it? Yeah. And so it is not that unusual, you know, coris fracture. And he has seen it in younger people also, younger than, you know, 40 or, you know, 50 years of age. Okay, so now let's move on with this outline that is the arm, forearm, hand one. Okay, and there we remember we came in the upper extremity and we did the axilla, we did the, you know, the boundaries, this, that, everything, the contents, and then we came, you know, to look at, you know, the entire skeleton of the upper extremity. Of course, you know, I did, you know, skip and go and expect you to look at the skeleton. And then we came to do the joints. And so we are finishing up the joints. We've done the shoulder joint, the elbow joint, and we have done the, what is called the, you know, the wrist joint. And now we're going to be, you know, looking at, so this is where we turned off, you know, the lunate displacement, carpal tunnel syndrome. Carpal tunnel syndrome will hopefully be done, you know, today or sometime in the middle. And now, intercarpal joint or metacarpal joint. Intercarpal joint or metacarpal. Intercarpal. So here we have carpals, all these eight bones. Intercarpal or metacarpal, you know, joints. Intercarpal or metacarpal, what type was it? So immediately we can move on. What is it? What type is it? Synovial plane, synovial plane. So what type of movement do we expect? Synovial plane. Gliding. But the gliding here has a clinical thing for you. That is, the gliding here helps, enhances the movement of the hand and the wrist. This gliding, even though this is just simple gliding, you know, it enhances the movement, you know, at the wrist joint. And that is, you know, one of the things you need to, you know, keep in mind. And then there's another, you know, thing about articulating parts you can easily see. Another thing about all these, you know, joints here, intercarpal joints and carpal metacarpal joints, all of them here have a common capsule, common fibrous capsule. What's the clinical significance for you as a physician? Clinical significance of having, there's one big fibrous capsule, you know, enclosing all this, except the carpal metacarpal joint of the thumb and also the PCO, you know, triquetral, this joint here, except this one and this one. All these others, you know, intercarpal and carpal metacarpals have one joint capsule, a common joint capsule. What's the clinical significance there? Infection. If you have infection in one joint cavity, it can spread to the others. Okay? And so the synovial membrane is the same going on. And so, but here, the carpal, metacarpal joint of the thumb is, you know, really protected. It's protected. Because remember, carpal metacarpal joint, we need the thumb to do many things. So that carpal metacarpal joint, you know, that joint space is, you know, really, you know, protected. I'm going to, if you are interested in looking at the blood supply and innovations, you can look at them, because as a physician, you may have to know when you are, you know, treating, you know, a patient. But for exams, I don't think anybody's going to pay attention to little blood vessel going to these little joints. But generally speaking, you need to know what blood vessels are here, you know, so that, you know, from where is it coming, not just exactly, you know, as we did in case of the hip joint. Remember, we went over medial and lateral circumflex femoral arteries going to the head is not as, you know, significant here, because there's the you have your, you know, the anastomoses, number of them, and so what anastomosis would you find here is from there you will, these joints will be getting blood supply. There are carpal, you know, dorsal and ventral, carpal, you know, what you call anastomosis of blood vessels, you know, taking place here. And so that is from where the blood supply is coming, and innervation is the same, you know, what nerves are, you know, there. What nerves are coming in here? We are going to be looking at the nerves, you know, pretty soon. Okay, and then we move on to, okay, that I have gone over, carpal, metacarpal joints of the thumb, yeah. But of the thumb, I'd like to go over here, this one here. Carpal, metacarpal joint of the thumb. What type of a joint is it? Saddle type of a, you know, joint, and so therefore what type of movements would you have? Saddle joint has what? Flexion, extension, adduction, abduction, anything else? Yeah, it also has axial rotation. Flexion, extension, adduction, abduction, and it has axial rotation. Anything else at the saddle joint? Exactly. Apposition, you know, at the saddle joint is also taking place. And it has its own fibrous capsule, synovial membrane, and movements we have, you know, gone over. And then we come to the carpal and carpal joint of the thumb, joint cavity, fibrous capsule, synovial membrane. Yes, it has all those. And let's move right here to metacarpal phalangeal joints. No, because this we have gone over a lot every time. But yeah, I'll come to you in a minute, Priya. Because every time you look at what joint is it, you know, what is this? Because now you know when it's a synovial joint, plain, what type of movement, what is it? Yeah, Priya. Carpal joint of the thumb. Or carpal metacarpal. That should be plain. That should be plain. That carpal metacarpal joint. Carpal metacarpal joint of the others are what? Wait. What are they? Huh? Condyloid. I'm sorry. Yeah, condyloid. And so, condyloid, what would you, in layman's language, what would you call the carpal metacarpal joint of the lateral medial four digits? The knuckles. So here are the knuckles. Okay? So knuckles. So the carpal metacarpal joint here. Wait, carpal metacarpal. Carpal metacarpal is not the knuckle. Wait, I'm coming to that. Okay, I'm doing the metacarpal. Carpal metacarpal joints is what I was doing. Okay? And so carpal metacarpal joints, labor is
cut.
Okay, so here, so we have the carpal metacarpal joints. Okay, now these carpal metacarpals, these are not knuckles. They are not knuckles. Your knuckles are metacarpal phalangeals are the knuckles. There you have, you know, a little bit more movement. Okay, so here, what you have, they are plain. They are plain synovial. And so they have, you know, the carpal metacarpal joints of the all the others, you know, are the plane. That means, you know, we'll have the same small degree, you know, of movement. So that is what the carpal metacarpal, you know, joints have here. Carpal metacarpal. Okay. Now, let me see here, where would the person have seen that here? In the outline, Katie, in the outline. have an issues, cargo, like a travel, join the pack, okay? And then, metacarpal phalangeal, now we are coming to you. Okay, let's move to the metacarpal phalangeal, and those are now the knuckles. Let's move on to the knuckles here. Now, what type we have already said, Alex has said, is condyloid. Okay, they are condyloid, you know, movements, and so condyloid joints. So for the condyloid joints, metacarpal phalangeal. Okay, so here are the metacarpals, and here are the phalanges, and so here these are the knuckles that we're talking about. So there, what kind of, you know, movements we do have, you know, for the knuckles. Flexion, extension, adduction, abduction, anything else? Yeah, it's also, you know, capable of, you know, circumduction. Okay, and then we have, after the carpometacarpal, now when we talk about these joints as synovial, then you already know what synovials should have, okay? The details of the synovials at the metacarpal phalangeal of the thumb, that we have gone over that. Now, the interphalangeal joints, what are they? What type are they? That means they are synovial hinge. And so if they are hinge joints, what movements are there? Flexion and extension only. And as you look at these diagrams, you can see they have all the details. That means interphalangeals, you know, distal and proximal interphalangeals, they have the fibrous capsules, renal membrane, lining, all those, you know, are there. And then when you come in here, you know you have two dip and, you know, hip, the clinical people will say. This will come in other, you know, classes also. They will be talking about the degree of flexion and extension, arthritic changes, all those. They will also be building on, you know, these. But right now, then when you know these are, you know, just, you know, the hinge type of synovial joint, you know, what is supposed to be the normal, you know, movements. And let me see. Extensor expansions help these joints a little bit. That means, what are extensor expansions? Extensor expansions help these joints in terms of their structures here. Extensor expansions, what are they? Extensor expansions, we mentioned it when we talked about, you know, the foot. Extensor expansions, what are they and what do they do? Extensor expansions.
Tendons from the extensor muscles?
What are they? Define the extensor expansions. Exactly. So, expansions of... Are you laughing at me or at Moriam or what is the reason?
We can hear you. And you said
you can't hear. Then you have to tell me, because when I bring it close, then, you know, it's too loud. That's why you have to tell me. So, because I can hear myself, that's why I move on. Can you hear me now? Can you hear now? Pardon me?
We can't hear the response.
Oh, you couldn't hear Moria. Oh, then you have to say, we don't know what exactly you mean. Instead of laughing. When you laugh at me sometimes, when you laugh like that, I sometimes feel very bad. You know, I let you know how I feel. I feel bad and I think she's laughing at me. Or at the class. That's what is happening. Okay, so I have to let you know how I exactly feel. Okay, so instead of laughing, just tell me, okay, that I couldn't hear you, or what did you, could you please repeat it? That way I know you're not laughing at me. Okay, yeah, Katie.
Because nobody responded.
No, I wasn't joking. I was kind of sad, though. Before Philip, I wasn't joking. I was kind of sad deep with it, because there wasn't the answers were not coming forth, and I thought these type of joints were dealt with in the foot, and then it's the same application here, and then people are not responding, and so that's why it's kind of sad inside. But I didn't show you that. Yes, there was a question, something. Yeah.
I was just saying that I heard a lot of people responding, we just weren't responding loud enough.
Okay. Okay, good. Good, okay, let's move on. Let's not waste time on... Oh, all right. Expense or expansions, Mariam answered, and others did too. All right. They are expansions of the extensor tendons, and they form like a hood, and they support. They support these joints as you come. And then... What else would you think of extensor expansions? What is it? It's expansions of the extensor tendons that come right over where you will find it is at the metacarpophalangeal joint. You will find it begins here. It goes right up to the proximal interphalangeal joint. It also allows, what else does it allow, extensor expansion? Muscle insertion, small muscles, your interossei and your lumbricals. In the rosacea and the lumbricals go into extensor expansions. The some of them are, you know, here, but when you see more of it is, you know, both the hands and in the foot we have that, but you may take a look at them sometime, but I'm not going to spend more time on extensor expansions. Now, the movements of these joints we have gone over. Now, the bones of the upper extremity, if you haven't studied, please, you know, study them. Now, the joints of the upper extremity are done. Do you have any questions on the joints of the upper extremity? Yeah. Flexion? I didn't hear the question. The flexion and extension are taking, what is taking place at the intercarpal joints here, plain synovial joints here, is only when you have, you know, the gliding, okay? So flexion and extension are taking place, that was the question, flexion and extension are taking place at the interphalangeal joints, okay? And the same flexion and extension will also take place at the knuckles. But there's also other movements at the knuckles because they are condyloid. Okay? Anybody else? No? Okay, so now, so you can see how and where I'm going with this in the outline is that now I'm done with all this. Skeleton is done, the joints are done. Now we're going back to do the muscles. Okay? Now, why going back to do the muscles? Because remember, this outline is, you know, forearm, hand, one. That means there will be some structures from the arm, some structures from the forearm, some structures that are going to the hand. Because this is happening here, that's why the outline says that. So after doing all this, now I'm going back to the arm to do the muscles. And so you'll be wondering, why are we back in the arm? But remember, we didn't do any muscles of the arm. I mentioned some of the muscles. You might have seen them in your dissection, but I did not, you know, do them in class. I will not stay too long with them. But here, when you go to look at the muscles here, so we have what we can call an anterior. This is way up, high up here, but when you look in the middle here and at the lower part here, you can call, you have more an anterior compartment and a posterior compartment. So here again is the same. It's the same here, but since this is high up, you also have, you know, some other, you know, muscles that means the deltoid laterally. But when you really look at the arm here, you have an anterior compartment and a posterior compartment. when you look in the anterior compartment, the upper extremity, the entire anterior compartment is, what is this compartment? What would you call this compartment? The flexor compartment, the flexor compartment, okay? So this is the, we are going to first look at the flexor compartment. You can see what muscles are in the flexor compartment, what muscles are in the extensor compartment. That is where we are going to go. Then we will go look at the nerves and the arteries and the like. Okay, here. Now, the okay, what muscle do you see in the brachium? In the anterior compartment of the brachium, what muscle do you see? Biceps brachii, is that the only one? Anterior compartment? Brachialis and anything else? Biceps brachii, coracobrachialis, and brachialis. So you can see the biceps brachii, you know a whole lot about the biceps brachii. Okay, you know the actions, you know the origins, what nerve is innervating the biceps brachii muscle?
Muscular cutaneous.
What nerve is innervating it? Biceps brachii. Musculocutaneous. Musculocutaneous nerve. So, musculocutaneous, biceps brachii, musculocutaneous. Musculocutaneous. The spinal rules is C5, 6, and 7. And spinal rules of biceps of the musculocutaneous muscle, biceps brachii. Of course, it has two heads of origin. Now, look at the diagram here and any place else that you know, look at. Often students make a mistake on this one here, in this section, not here, in this section. This is the head, as you look at it, this is the long head. This is the long head. The long head of the biceps is coming from where? It's coming from where? The supraglenoid tubercle. The supraglenoid tubercle. And the short head is coming from where? The coracoid process. The coracoid process. The coracoid process. And so the two heads of origin, but insertion is just by one tendon. And you know the tendon inserts into the radius, but you don't know this one. You might not have, you know, seen or heard about this one. Bicipital aponeurosis. Bicipital aponeurosis. So biceps brachii also has, you know, an insertion. You can see some of his fibers are just expanding and going, what we call it, the bicipital aponeurosis. Okay? So it's called the bicipital aponeurosis. In living anatomy, some of you, I asked some of you to tense it and feel it. And so you can really, you know, sense it like that. Tense the muscle here. You can really feel on this, you know, this surface here, you can feel. So that is where it is inserting. When you go to dissect this part, you will see you really have a hard time cutting through, you know, that over there. So that is biceps brachii. And what are its actions? Quick. Flexion of what? You see, you have to be more specific now. Flexion of what? The forearm or flexion at the elbow. Forearm or flexion at the elbow. And anything else? Supination also. Remember, it also can supinate. Supination also. That is the biceps brachii. And then we go to coracobrachialis. Coracobrachialis tells you from where to where it's coming and or, you know, going. And coracobrachialis. So here, well, so since you know from where to where it's coming and going, coracobrachialis, coracoid process to the brachium, it only goes about, you know, that far deep, you know, below here. You can only see the skinny muscle, as Dr. Brinton was showing it. And what's the innervation of the coracobrachialis muscle?
Same.
Musculocutaneous. And then we come to the other muscle in the anterior compartment here, the brachialis muscle. Often, you know, people don't talk about it because it's below, it's under, it's deep to the vicus brachii. And so here you see cortical brachialis, now you can see a little, you know, better. Right deep to the vicus brachii, here you have a really big, strong, powerful flexor of the forearm. Powerful flexor of the forearm. It can flex the forearm in any position. The forearm can be in any position. It can flex the forearm in all positions, and it's a very powerful muscle here. And you can see the musculocutaneous nerve coming right down to, you know, the muscle fibers here. So it is the musculocutaneous nerve, and its insertion you can easily see. You don't have to memorize it. You can easily see its insertion to the ulna, you know, right over here you can see. So that is the anterior compartment muscles of the arm. Anterior compartment muscles of the arm. Okay? Let's go to the posterior compartment of the arm. The posterior compartment here has only one muscle. Okay, the triceps brachii. As you look at the triceps brachii, some people may say there are three muscles because of the three heads of origin. Okay? And so, as you look at it, it has a long head, a lateral head, and it has deep to these two, you know, right from, you know, the bone, from the humerus, you have a medial head also. Medial head also, you know, taking origin. Now let me ask you this question. You can see the lateral head taking origin, you know, from the humerus. And from where is the long head of the triceps coming? Long head of the biceps. Infra. That's right. Infra. Glenoid tubercle. And why did I ask that specifically? Infraglenoid tubercle. How could you have gotten that without even, suppose you didn't have a chance to read or anything like that, and how could you have figured it out? Look at the supraglenoid, the long head of the biceps, is taking origin from the supraglenoid tubercle here. See how easy it is when you really think about it and figure out, instead of memorizing, wasting all your time memorizing. And then, infraglenoid tubercle here, from there, you have the long head of the triceps taking origin. How more, you know, beautiful can it get? I would say, how more romantic can it get? And so, supraglenoid tubercle, long head of the biceps. Infraglenoid tubercle, you know, the long head of the triceps. You see? And so there's such a, you know, way of figuring out some of these things. Okay? Don't forget, the person who got 47% and the person who got 98%, it's not that the person who got 98% is the, you know, is a genius, and the person who got 47%, you know, is not, you know, as intellectually capable or anything like that. It's how you use your time to get this information, and how you get this information, how you're storing that information, that is the difference. Okay? How you get it, instead of memorizing everything. What nerves have? L4-5S1, L5-S1-2. I've told a few of you, there are a few nerves with those. Same spinal roots, you see? So you can save a lot of time by using all these. Supraglenoid, infraglenoid. Long head of biceps, long head of triceps. See? So that is what one of the things you need to also keep in mind. And then, of course, you know the nerve. What nerve is innervating the triceps brachii muscle? Triceps brachii.
Radial nerve.
And so that is the, and its insertion you have already seen, and what is its action? Let's finish quickly and go. What is its action? extension of what though? See, extension alone is not the extension of the. Okay, good, thank you. So she says, move on, we know it. All right, thank you, thank you, thank you. Okay, extension of the elbow. And so that is that. So we are done with the muscles of it. Do you have a question there? Okay, no. Okay, if you have. Sarah, at the back, can you hear me? Okay. Now, so let's move on to the muscles are done, and now what is here? Okay, in the posterior compartment, radial nerve for distribution. Spinal roots, okay, wait. Spinal roots of the radial nerve. Spinal roots of the radial nerve. Radial nerve. C5, 6, C7, C8, and T1. You may see it written in different ways. You may see without the 5, you may see, you know, with this, with that. This is what is, you know, classically known as and accepted. That is the radial nerve. That is the radial nerve, C5, 6, 7, 8, and, you know, T1. Okay, ventroprimary rami off. All right, and so then let's move on to the here that clinical notes. Okay, clinical notes. We have gone over a little bit of this clinical note. Okay, let me go over the clinical note before I go over the what clinical note I have here. But a little bit here is the musculocutaneous nerve. Okay, now we have. Mentioned the musculocutaneous nerve. Now, before, how many terminal branches does the brachial plexus have? 5 terminal branches of the brachial plexus. Okay, good. Now, 4 out of the 5 terminal branches of the brachial plexus just pass through the brachium. They do not give any. You know, they don't give any innervation in the anterior, you know, compartment. In the anterior compartment, you have the coracobrachialis nerve here. So clinically, I'm going to take you through the clinical thing here. Okay. So here you have seen what are the muscles that are being innervated by the musculocutaneous. You've seen all 3 flexor muscles of the anterior compartment are innervated by the musculocutaneous. Suppose the musculocutaneous nerve has a lesion or is injured or is damaged here in the axilla here. What functions will be lost? What functions will be lost? Your patient will not be able to do what? Flexion of the forearm, anything else? Supination. Will it be completely lost? I heard gentle nose from here, gentle nose from the middle of the class. So will the flexion be completely lost? No. Good for you. No. Okay. Will the supination be completely lost? No. Okay. Good. Why not? Why not? Supinator, there is a muscle called supinator. Supinator will be, you know, participating, and that means biceps is not the only one that is, you know, supinating. And how about flexion? The brachioradialis, which we haven't done yet, but from your readings or from the diagram, these people have seen that there is a muscle called the brachioradialis, okay? And so let me take you to that muscle, even though it is an extensor muscle. And so right here, you can see the, you can see part of the brachioradialis right here. You can see it's coming. Brachioradialis is a muscle. It has origin from the, what is called the lateral. So here, brachioradialis, here is the brachium, okay? This is the whole thing here. And so here you can see the brachioradialis takes origin from, you know, the lateral, you know, lip of, you know, the lateral supracondylar ridge of the humerus, from the humerus, and its name tells you where the third is it insert. Brachioradialis. Radius, okay? Brachioradialis. So that is a flexor. Even though we will talk about it today in the extensor compartment, but it is a flexor. So because it can flex, all the flexion by the what you call your brachialis, your basis brachii, will not be lost, but it will be weakened. So damage to the muscular cutaneous nerve in the axilla will automatically, you know, cut off innervation to these flexor muscles here, but the flexion of the forearm is not going to be completely lost because, you know, it is going to be weakened. The flexion is going to be weakened and the supination is also not lost but weakened. So weakened supination, and so this is how you have to, you know, think of and work problems, you know, when you hear about damage or lesion of a nerve, you have to see, and I'm not going to take you through all the nerves like this, so you have an idea as to how to work these problems out, you know, when you get a problem, or when you get a situational question, how to work this out. Katie, you have a question? Yes, the muscular cutaneous, does it have cutaneous innervation also? Yes. The diagram here, you guys should use the diagram a lot. Because now you know what I look like. How do you know that? From seeing me so many times, isn't it? I mean, you even know me from behind my back if I'm walking in the parking lot. From out of the way, you know this woman goes, okay? The same way, when you look at the diagram, in the picture, just gaze at it. I said this a while ago here. Gaze at it and get that picture in your mind. Here it is. Here it is, Katie. Here is the cutaneous innervation. Cutaneous innervation that is coming to this area via, and you can see that here. See? This is the cutaneous branch coming to this part, coming to this part of the forearm. And so then when Dr. Lau puts a pin there and asks you for cutaneous innervation in this area. She might not have mentioned it in this section, but she knows I go over it here in theory. That's why, you know, she would ask you that, okay? And so, yes, it has. And its name tells you, musculocutaneous. No, it doesn't have, you know, cutaneous innervation of the arm, and so it only has, you know, innervation in the forearm, okay? And so that's the clinical note, and so that is the artery. And then that's the nerve that we mentioned, you know, today. And then another nerve also, you know, here, what we mentioned was the radial nerve. The radial nerve, when we, you know, look at the radial nerve, you know, what will happen? What compartment, first of all, what compartment do you find the radial nerve in? The extensor compartment. That means here, the extensor compartment. Also, when it comes here, this is also the extensor compartment. This is the extensor compartment also. That where also you will find, yeah. So you will also find the radial nerve there. And so, what is the radial nerve then innervating? What muscles? What type of muscles? Extensors. So if you have a damage, you know, to the radial nerve right here, you can see. Let's go here. Radial nerve here. You can see the nice radial nerve here. And so what will happen, you know, it also goes into the forearm. It also gives, you know, innervation, the muscles in the forearm, extensor muscles in the forearm. So if this nerve has a lesion, this nerve is damaged, what would be demonstrated by your patient? Yeah, it's not able to extend. What about the elbow, Neil? Is it able to extend the elbow?
No.
Yes or no?
No.
no. Okay, so then how about the wrist here? No. Good. And I can see. No, I can. You know why I'm happy? Because she's trying to figure it out in her head and she's saying yes or no to herself. That is good. Wrist drop. So radial nerve always associates radial nerve with this diagnosis. That is wrist drop. We may come to some of these again, but for the time being, wrist drop. Okay, wrist drop. Always associate wrist drop with the radial nerve. With the radial nerve, okay? And it's going to be like that, you know. This is flexed like that. This wrist drop is what you can easily see. Okay, now this will also become a little bit more interesting to you after we have done the extensor muscles of the forearm. Then, you know, you will. The full understanding of the effect of the radial nerve will be, you know, understood maybe a little better, because I can see some people are trying to do the movements, you know, they are, you know, trying to figure out. That is good. Now, the other nerves that are passing there, but they don't have innervation in the arm. That means you have the ulnar nerve passing there, median nerve passing there, and what is the other one? Axillary already goes up, you know, here. It doesn't come down. So the median and the ulnar, we will deal with the median and ulnar lesions as we come to do the innervation of those in the forearm and in the hand. And so the next thing here is the arteries of the brachium, very quick and fast we can go, and the arteries as you look at it here. And you already know a lot about the arteries in the brachium. The continuation of the axillary artery comes down in the brachium as the brachial artery. And so then, and in the posterior compartment of the arm, just like in the thigh, you know, you have the deep artery of the arm, deep artery of the arm, okay? Now, because we have a lower extremity with the same deep artery, you know, of the thigh, if you say deep artery in a dissection lab exam, you have to specify, you have to, you know, qualify that and say deep artery of the arm, okay? Or profunda brachii artery, profunda brachii, or deep artery of the arm, you know, is in the posterior compartment and supplying blood to those structures in the posterior compartment. What else comes to your mind about the deep artery of the arm? Other than its blood supply, other than its a branch of the brain, what else comes to your mind?
Circumflex.
Yeah, that's right. It is lying close to, against the shaft of the femur. And what other structure, what neural structure travels with it or is found? The radial nerve. Remember that? Radial nerve. So the radial nerve and the deep brachial artery here, and the deep artery of the arm, not deep brachial, deep artery of the arm, are traveling together in the shaft, you know, on the shaft of the humerus. And remember, so fracture of the humerus, the shaft of the humerus, body of the humerus, you know, can damage those two structures that you want to keep in mind. And then, of course, the brachial artery comes right down past the elbow. It comes past the elbow and then only divides into a radial artery and an ulnar artery. Okay? And then anastomosis at the elbow. Just like the anastomosis that we have seen around the knee, this one is much easier because you can see it much better in this section, and you can see what are the major arteries that are giving branches to this anastomosis. Anastomosis around the elbow. Anastomosis around the elbow. As you look at it here, you have the brachial artery. And you can see the branch here, superior ulnar collateral, because coming to the ulnar artery and inferior collateral. And then from the ulnar, you have the recurrent arteries. Remember, anything recurrent is when it's traveling back up. Recurrent. So the ulnar artery gives branches, that is anterior and posterior recurrent branches. And then we have from the deep artery of the arm, here you have a branch, collateral. See, there's a branch coming right down here, middle collateral artery. And then, again, here, radial collateral coming. And you have from the radial artery, you can see, going back up. And so from the, what is it, as a physician, are you going to be, are you going to remember the collaterals and the recurrence and all that? What I like a physician to know when she or he is practicing 15 years into her practice, I like the physician to know that the anastomosis around the elbow, you know, has branches from the forearm arteries. Forearm arteries are your radial artery and the ulnar artery. And branches from your, you know, brachial artery and your deep artery of the arm. That is what he or she may be able to remember. Okay? And so, because that's, why I thought of that was because Nirala Chakobi, who was trained here as a naturopathic physician a few years ago, and you know that research letter kind of that comes around, I don't know if you guys read it, and she's written an article in the current world, she's in Australia now. And when I saw the name Nirala Chakobi, I said, geez, I taught Nirala. And so she was writing about the hemorrhoids. She was writing about the hemorrhoids. Because I know Nirala, I read it. I just wanted to see what she's, you know, saying. And from, you know, some of these things when I read, I, you know, see, she was saying vascular tissue, that's this vascular tissue, that's that. I thought, geez, after 8 or 10 years, this is how they start using the information, vascular tissue. And if Nirala was in my class at the time, I said, what are you talking about? Vascular tissue, Nirala. These are veins. These are veins, you know, varicose veins, you know, around the anal orifice, internal and external, you know, hemorrhoids. So she defined internal and external hemorrhoids. But I was happy, she remembered that, and I was happy that she wrote, you know, the article. So that's why I think of what will these physicians remember, what they are learning today. And so what's the easiest way? Yes, anastomosis at the elbow. There is an anastomosis. And what does this anastomosis do? Well, what does this do? What does this anastomosis at the elbow do? Just like any other place. It ensures blood supply to the structures, you know, below here if there is a blockage or, you know, ligation. And that is what anywhere when you have an anastomosis, that is, you know, happening. And then we have veins in the arm. Remember, we are finishing up the arm, okay? We have done the muscles, then the nerves, and then the arteries, and then we have the veins in the anterior compartment, in the posterior compartment. And when we come to look at the veins, we have deep veins and superficial veins in the arm. And the deep veins in the arm, and not too many people, you know, show some of these things around here. And what are the deep veins? What would you say are the deep veins in the anterior compartment of the arm? Yeah. Liat. You have a question or you want to answer? Question?
Take a break.
Take a break? All right. Okay. Just take a break. Okay. Brachial veins. What would you call them? Vene cavitate. In Kamika, the companion means of what artery? Regular artery. So you should follow the principles. Deep arteries take what? How are the deep arteries named?
The reason of which they're traveling.
The region in which it's traveling. How are the deep veins named? Just as the arteries. Okay, so what is the deep vein? What are the deep veins in the brachium?
Brachial veins,
okay? And then when you go to the posterior compartment of the arm, what artery did you see?
Posterior. Deep vein, profunda brachial.
What artery? Deep artery of the arm. So what vein, deep vein would you see there?
Deep vein of the arm,
yes. Vine comitante. They are companion veins. They travel along. Vine comitante means companion veins. They travel side by side. They are like, think of the US president who has bodyguards. Okay? And the bodyguards are always not seen, but he does, or they, he, she, whoever. The president has bodyguards traveling with him. So the vine comitante are like that. Think of that, okay? And vine comitante are companion veins traveling with medium-sized arteries all over the body. Posterior tibial, anterior tibial, superior gluteal, inferior gluteal, radial, ulnar, what do you call this one, profunda brachial, all those have companion veins. That means two veins traveling side by side as, you know, Secret Service, you know, protectors of the president. Alright? And so that's vene comitante or companion veins. Alright, now, superficial veins that you don't know. Superficial veins don't take the names, they don't follow the logic. They have separate names, but different reasons. In the arm, that means the brachium. I'm not talking about here, I'm talking about the arm. You have a saphenic vein and you have a basilic vein. The saphenic vein and the basilic vein, reasonably big, both of them are reasonably big and both of them are superficial. And then the saphenic, both of them, just like in the foot, both of them take origin from the dorsal venous arch or the dorsal venous plexus that you will find over the palm, right over, you know, here, when you go to the palm, let me see, well, I'm not going to go to another, to the palm, I have to go to the other outline to get the palm, but we will come to the palm, when we come to the palm, I will, you know, talk about it again, and it's taking origin from here, just like in the foot, it's taking origin from here, both of them, okay, one on the radial side, that is the saphenic, and one on the ulnar side, from the dorsal venous plexus, and goes, you know, right, you know, over in here, and what happens to the basilic vein? What do you know about the basilic vein? It forms what? The axillary vein. It forms the axillary vein by uniting with what other veins? Brachial veins. So this superficial vein, this one here, about the middle of the arm, right about here somewhere, you know, the lower, you know, one third and the, you know, half here, it becomes deep, like means it pierces the deep fascia, goes and travels up a little bit, okay? And it travels up, and about here, you know, in the axilla, close to the axilla there, they unite and they form what is called your axillary vein. They form the axillary vein there. Cephalic doesn't do that. Cephalic travels, what does cephalad or cephal mean? Head. So that goes toward the head, but doesn't get to the head. It, you know, right immediately below the clavicle, it pierces, you know, the deep fascia there and joins up the axillary vein. It is joining the axillary vein, not the subclavian. Not the subclavian, okay? Yeah, just a little before, you know, the subclavian vein. That means the cephalic vein is joining, right about here, is joining the upper part of the axillary vein, okay? So that cephalic is not forming the axillary vein. It is, I haven't seen it forming any place. And it goes into the axillary vein after it was formed, okay? So it acts as a tributary to the axillary vein. Okay? So those are the superficial veins and the deep veins, and you know, they have, they have valves and everything, and, you know, so it carries, you know, a lot of blood and going on. And in the forearm, in the posterior compartment, the forearm, now I'm done with the arm, arteries, veins, muscles, you know, everything of the arm is done, going to the forearm. So when we come into the forearm, we have the, what bones do you have in the forearm? Radius and ulna. Here you have the radius and ulna. The two of them you will be looking at, if you haven't already, please look at the skeletal, you know, details. And when this thing opens up, you can see radius and ulna together with the interosseous membrane would form an anterior compartment and the posterior compartment of the forearm much clearer than the arm. The arm has an anterior compartment, posterior compartment, but with only one bone is only the deep fascial septae, you know, that are, you know, going to the skin and the superficial fascia. And so here, then we come in the anterior compartment of the forearm. Let's go to the anterior compartment, and you already know the anterior compartment is anterior and posterior compartments. What do we have here? Okay, but let's go with the muscles. And as we come to look at the muscles in the anterior compartment of the arm, of the forearm, you have superficial muscles and deep muscles. You may remember, you know, the, here, you may remember the leg. Remember, you had an anterior compartment, a posterior compartment, and a lateral compartment. Here, we only have an anterior compartment and a posterior compartment. And so when you look at the anterior compartment muscles here, you have five superficial muscles. And Dr. Moore has a very easy way. He was the only author that I've seen, you know, has given this, you know, that how you can classify these muscles, you know, based on, I think he has given a picture of that also in the textbook. From first edition onwards, he started, you know, doing that. You know, so 10, 15 years ago, he started doing that. He says, you know, the thumb, if you put the heel of your thumb, yes, right over there, can you stand up and show it to the class? No? Yeah, just get the blood flowing and stand up and, yeah, hold on.
I'm just following you.
I see, I thought you were showing you. Yes, you know. That is good. We didn't laugh today, so we had to laugh, isn't it? And so when you put the heel of your palm right here, the thumb indicates the pronator teres. And the index finger, you know, flexor carpi radialis. You remember that name? Flexor carpi radialis. From where do you remember that name? Exactly, orientation. Dr. Lau was nonstop going, remember? You know, with the suit on, she was talking about flexor carpi radialis. And then, you know, palmaris longus, she didn't talk about that. And then extensor digitorum, you know, superficialis. And then flexor carpi ulnaris, flexor carpi ulnaris. Now, when you look at all these names, when you look at all these names, you would see where each of these is coming from. Pronator teres, okay. Pronator teres, what does that tell you? It tells you a lot, but what do you understand? Pronator teres. It's a pronator muscle. It is a pronator muscle, teres. You've seen teres major, teres minor. What do you know? It's kind of an oblong, kind of an oval-shaped, kind of roughly oblong muscle. Pronator teres. So now you already know. Pronator teres is one of the superficial muscles, okay? So you have pronator teres, and then you have flexor carpi radialis muscle. Flexor carpi radialis. That tells you everything about that muscle. Its origin, its insertion, its action. That tells you everything about flexor carpi radialis longus. What is it flexing? Carpus, what is carpus?
The wrist.
So flexor carpi radialis muscle is flexing the wrist. Is flexing the wrist. Flexor carpi radialis. And then we have palmaris longus. So here we have, you know, there's the flexor carpi radialis, flexor pulsus. So this should be flexor carpi radialis muscle here. And then we have the palmaris longus. And so that is going to insert into the palmar aponeurosis. And then we have flexor digitorum superficialis. And then we have flexor carpi ulnaris. Flexor carpi ulnaris. Okay? And as you look at this diagram here, you can see some of them separately from, you know, nearer. Okay, look at this one here. Okay? Individually. This is beautifully illustrated. These are the illustrations that carries, you know, what you call the nether, you know, a lot. Because everybody gets, you know, so crazy about it. Flexor, carpi, radialis. So all these five superficial flexor muscles of the forearm have a common origin. And so medial epicondyle. So you see why I told you to study the bones first, medial epicondyle. When it says medial epicondyle, you don't have to go back and forth. And so then palmaris longus. Where is it going? And so here is, you know, flexor carpi ulnaris. Flexor carpi ulnaris, not only it flexes, you know, the wrist, but what else do you think flexor carpi, you know, ulnaris can do? What else? Look at its insertion, flexor carpi ulnaris. Look at its insertion. What bones are it inserting to? What are these bones? These are carpal bones. It can also ulnar deviation. It can also ulnar deviate. Okay. So these five muscles, except the flexor carpi ulnaris, what nerve do you think should innervate these pronator teres? Bless you, pronator teres, flexor carpi radialis, palmaris longus, flexor digitorum superficialis. Where do you think, what nerve do you think should innervate? Which one? Ulnaris for the flexor carpi radialis, flexor carpi ulnaris, okay? Which median, exactly, median nerve, because the median nerve is traveling right in the forearm. And the median nerve, you did not see any, distribution for the median nerve. And so we will take the median nerve as we come to do the, let's go here. Median nerve right here. Okay, here, look at the median nerve here. Here is the median nerve coming, so it begins to give distribution here in the forearm. You can see pronator teres and the others, and then of course it passes in the into the hand right there. And so that is the median nerve. That is the superficial group. And you have a question.
Yeah. What's the difference between adduction at the wrist and ulnar deviation?
Adduction at the wrist is and ulnar deviation is the same. There's no difference. It's the same.
Okay.
It's the same. There was a chair. If you have a question.
I have the identical.
Okay. And was there a hand in place here? No? Okay. Then, so those are the superficial. And now, if you really just look at the narrow diagrams of these muscles, you really will get all the information you need you know, to get. So those are the five superficial muscles of the forearm. Then we have, so here look at the flexor digitorum superficialis. Look where it's going, where it's inserting, and so how its insertions and origins are going to be doing what the textbook will, you know, talk about. And then we have three superficial muscles in, three deep muscles in the forearm. Those three deep muscles, one of them is flexor pollicis longus. Flexor pollicis longus, what do you think it will be flexing? The thumb. You have to be a little bit more specific. The thumb, that means the IP joints of the thumb. And look at this here, where it is inserting to the distal phalanx, the distal phalanx, okay? And then look at the flexor digitorum profundus. Flexor digitorum profundus. And so this muscle is very important. So is flexor pollicis longus and flexor digitorum profundus. Both are very important muscles in terms, why do you think I call them as very important? You look at their insertions and you tell me why these muscles, I would think of them as very important clinically. Why? Exactly. Thank you. So what you see is that they are the only muscles. They are the only muscles. Flexor digitorum profundus is the only muscle that can flex the distal phalanges, the distal IP joints, the distal IP joints. Look at their insertions. Okay? And by virtue of them calling off these tendons passing over the corpus, so it can also flex the wrist, it can also flex all the joints it is traveling over. Okay, it can flex all the joints it's traveling over. And now it's the same thing with flexor pollicis longus, the same thing. That's the only muscle that can flex the IP joints of the thumb. And so you have to be careful. And now, this is doubly, you know, protected by nature. That is, it has two innovations. Flexor digitorum profundus has an innovation from the ulnar nerve on the medial aspect, medial half, and you know the lateral half of the flexor digitorum profundus receives from which nerve do you think logically should? Median, exactly, median nerve. So flexor digitorum profundus muscle is very important. Because of its actions, because of its passing. So it receives from the median nerve here, in the medial half, in the lateral half. The medial half is from the ulnar nerve. And there is also one more deep flexor, that means deep muscle, not a flexor, but a deep muscle that you find here. That is your, where is the pronator? Quadratus. Pronator quadratus, that is, I have to look for it here. Pronator quadratus should be, okay, this is pronator quadratus. Pronator quadratus is not as clear a diagram here for you to see, but it comes, it's right about, you know, here it comes from the ulna. It comes from the anterior surface of the ulna, goes to the radius, you know, to the radius right here. So that is pronator, you know, quadratus. Now you've seen two muscles, pronator teres, pronator quadratus. Okay? Pronator teres and pronator, you know, quadratus. So pronator teres, as you know, look at the pronator, you know, quadratus and pronator teres. Now, which one do you think is more important, and which one do you think initiates, you know, pronation? Which one would be the prime pronator? Here is the pronator, you know, quadratus muscle. You can see a good part of it here. It goes like that, okay? Now, from here to here. And which is more important? Which initiates the pronation? Quadratus. Quadratus. Teres, you know, comes into, there is, you know, comes into effect. There is comes into effect, and so pronator teres and pronator quadratus. Okay, so that, you know, both of them are, you know, important. And pronator, you know, quadratus, what nerve do you think should innervate? Just think, what nerve do you innervate? Median nerve. Now here, when it comes to the median nerve here, there's a thing. Let me take you through here. That is, here is the median nerve, okay? And now, the median nerve also goes into the palm. So before it goes into the palm, in addition to giving, you know, muscle, I mean, fibers to some of the muscles, it also gives a nerve here, a branch here, called the anterior interosseous nerve, okay? Anterior interosseous nerve, I'm writing this so that, because this is the first time we are talking about an interosseous nerve. That is the reason. Not that you cannot get the information or anything. There is an anterior interosseous nerve, anterior interosseous. Anterior interosseous nerve, that is a branch of the median nerve in the anterior compartment. There's a posterior interosseous nerve, it's in the posterior compartment, but it is a branch of the radial nerve. So don't get confused when you see that. Anterior interosseous nerve is a branch of the median nerve, and it is in the anterior compartment here. Posterior interosseous is a branch of the radial nerve, and it is, you know, in the posterior compartment. Now, I was going to continue and finish this, but we have something little interesting for you, and that interest is that I cannot finish the palm anyways here, so what I will do is I'll finish the rest the next day. Now, we have a person here, and so Dr. Kimberly Sandstrom. So Dr. Kimberly Sandstrom here is a first-year resident. She's a first-year resident from our university. She's a master's graduate. She's very eager to see you guys, your faces, and also to present a little case to you pertaining to the upper extremity. Would you like the microphone?
Where the infection was coming from, gave her antibiotics, and have this intense left shoulder pain. So she came in to see us. We got a little bit more history. The focus of the pain was right here. What muscle would that be?
Right here.
Yeah, anterior deltoid. And she had redness and swelling kind of going down to right above her elbow. Let's see. So she was holding her arm, and she really couldn't move it in any direction, but especially abduction. That was the most difficult. Advil didn't have any effect. She didn't really want to take the prescribed heavier duty analgesics. It was better with heat, worse with cold. And then on physical exam, her blood pressure was 100 over 60. Her heart rate was 110. Temperature 99.7. She was obviously in a lot of distress, a lot of pain. Like I said, edematous, erythematous, left shoulder. There was some edema over her clavicle, but there was no break in the skin, no abrasions, no puncture wounds, no bruising. And extreme tenderness to palpation, especially over her anterior deltoid and biceps. She had lymphadenopathy in the axillary lymph nodes that were very tender. And so basically no active range of motion. She just held her arm. Even when I went to move her off the pillow, the students had her lying on a pillow and had a heating pad because that's what she reported made it feel better. I took the heating pad off and then just went to move her arm a little bit, and she almost jumped off the table. And then with passive range of motion, we were able to slowly abduct her arm to about 90 degrees. That took a while. So what do you think our initial assessment was?
Infection.
Any ideas? I can't really hear you guys. Infection, bursitis. Anything else? Where would the infection be? Tendonitis. Any other ideas? Yeah, so what we wanted to do was make sure it wasn't septic arthritis, because you assume with monoarticular inflammatory, acute joint pain, you assume septic arthritis until proven otherwise, because that is what the most serious thing. Well, I mean, an MI is more serious than that, but that could progress to sepsis and death. So that was the first thing we wanted to rule out. So we sent her with her daughter right over to Northwest Hospital for a joint aspiration with synovial fluid analysis and culture. And so now I'll give you that report. So they did the left shoulder aspiration under fluoroscopic guidance to make sure they were getting up to the glenohumeral joint. And they drew out 7 cc's of fluid. Do you think that's the normal amount of fluid? No. It was non-hemorrhagic. It was clear, slightly yellow. The report was actually kind of confusing. So I had to call the radiologist and the lab tech to kind of get an idea of, I'm a newbie doc. I don't really know what this saying. So it said pearly. Like, is pearly normal? Is pearly not normal? It's not normal. That means it's kind of yellow. And then the synovial fluid was thicker than usual. That kind of confused me, because usually with septic arthritis, it's less viscous than normal. So it's thicker than normal. Like I said, 7 cc's. She experienced immediate relief after the joint aspiration. So that's what I got at first, and then kept on calling her. She was feeling a lot better.
Sorry, what's joint aspiration?
Joint aspiration is they go in with a needle and then draw out the fluid. So you use a syringe and draw out the fluid. And they used fluoroscopic, which is, imaging guidance to make sure they were in the joint. And so I called her the next day. She was doing so much better, could move her arm a little bit. Was taking Advil for the pain. no fever, just felt a lot better right after the joint aspiration. And then 4 days later, I get the culture results, and I'm thinking there have to be bacteria in here. I mean, she had a fever, supposedly she had elevated white blood cells, just looked really angry and infected, but no organisms were seen on the gram stain, only a moderate increase in white blood cells. And then, okay, so I had that right away. And then the culture 4 days later showed no organisms. And then they looked at the fluid to see, are there any crystals in here? Because it could be gout, it could be pseudo-gout, arthritis, or some other, you know, crystal formation. No crystals. And so I called her when I got those lab results, and she has no pain right now. And she has increased active mobility in her shoulder, no fever, and she doesn't need any analgesics. And so I'm thinking, I don't know, this doesn't really look like, it looks like it could be septic arthritis, but it doesn't look like classic septic arthritis. She did receive the antibiotics when she went into Swedish about 2 weeks ago, and that could kind of confuse the lab results. So I'm still sort of in this state of confusion. So what do? I run and talk to Dr. Dodge, talk to other people, try to figure it out. And just did some research this morning, so I have some other ideas. The patient went to another physical medicine appointment on Saturday, so I'm going to see how that went. And then I recommended, because this is her first visit ever to the clinic, so I don't know if she has diabetes, I don't know if she has, you know, some kind of, you know, immune deficiency, or I want to know what the underlying cause is. It wasn't, a, you know, something obvious like a trauma. In a lot of cases of septic arthritis, they're kind of like, whoa. About who she is, what her medical history is, so recommended that she come in for a patient care visit, and we're getting her past medical records to try to figure it out. So that's kind of where it is right now. What do you guys think? Any questions or ideas? Yeah. So septic arthritis is usually, it can be gonococcal, so a gonorrhea infection, or it's classified as non-gonococcal versus gonococcal for bacterial septic arthritis, and that's the most common cause of septic arthritis. But you can also have a viral infection, like Epstein-Barr, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, other viruses, and even fungi can cause septic arthritis. So you can have, and that's usually in like, you know, the HIV AIDS population. So you could have a candida infection in the joint. Any other questions or ideas? Yeah. Yes, that's what I was looking at today. What else could cause an increase in fluid? So the DDX for suspected septic arthritis, which you have to, you know, assume that until proven otherwise, and I'm not totally convinced that it's not septic arthritis, but it's not gout that could also cause increased fluid. Pseudo-gout, which is the calcium pyrophosphate crystals, other crystal arthropathies, and it's not that, because those things don't show up on the synovial fluid analysis. Other infections, arthritides, so Lyme's disease, TB, like I said, viruses, fungi, periarticular infections, like you guys thought, maybe bursitis, cellulitis, OA, if it's really aggravated, RA can sometimes present that way, so I want to get an x-ray of her shoulder and see if there's some underlying joint arthropathy, some joint damage. And then for little ones, it could be rheumatic fever, polymyalgia rheumatica, and then there's some other conditions that apply more to the peds population. And since monoarticular, you know, that's also, yeah, what's your question?
That was going to be my question. It sounds like a lot of those things, like Lyme disease, rheumatoid arthritis, would present in more than one joint.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Usually RA especially presents in more than one joint. And what joints are most commonly affected by RA? Yeah, hands, knees. I saw a woman a few days ago who can't walk. She has such bad RA in her knees. Yeah. Yeah, you don't just wake up with this throbbing, you know, hot red joint.
How old is
she? She's 61, African American female. That's what I'm thinking, yeah. But, oh, you, oh, I'm sorry. I'm not used to being in this big room. It's been a while. So she said, you know, the ER, they gave her the broad-spectrum antibiotics. She didn't remember what kind of antibiotics it was, so I assume it's, you know, broad-spectrum because they didn't really identify the infectious agent. And so maybe that kind of tweaked the lab results, so we're not seeing, you know, the classic presentation. And then... No, she saw us a week after she took the antibiotics. Yeah. And then usually for septic arthritis, they give IV antibiotics. Sometimes they have to go into the joint. You know, so if you just take oral antibiotics for septic arthritis, or, you know, she was probably given oral antibiotics, that wouldn't necessarily address the infection in her joint. I'll go back there first and then here. Yeah.
If she was that inflamed, though, wouldn't you still be seeing something even with antibiotics? Or would you still just be having an immune reaction?
That's possible, yeah. Like you're thinking complement and just the inflammatory process. Yeah. And then you had a question? Or somewhere down here? Yeah. She said, asked what causes increased viscosity or pearly color. The pearly color. So normal joint fluid is clear or made slightly yellow, and then classic septic arthritis is really yellow. And this was kind of in between, not normal, not classic. And then the viscosity, usually, you know, it's kind of viscous because it's, you know, that gooey fluid that keeps our joints all mobile. And then usually with inflammation and with septic arthritis, have an increase, a decreased viscosity, so it's more fluid. So she had an increased viscosity and then slightly yellow fluid. Uh-huh. She asked, is septic arthritis something that just comes on suddenly? Yes. It can just appear out of the blue. But usually there's some underlying cause, you know, if someone has type 1 or type 2 diabetes. Yeah.
If the lymph nodes were swollen, is it possible that there was an accumulation of lymph in the axillary region that maybe it just accumulated around the joint and some of it got into the joint capsule?
Did everyone hear that? Yeah, so another thing, what else were we concerned about? If you have axillary lymph node swelling, what do you want to make sure?
Cancer.
Breast cancer, yeah. So we asked her about that. She had a mammogram a few months ago, and that was negative. Did not. I knew I was going to get grilled when I came in here. No, because I was just focused on the shoulder and I was going to get her out of here. We call it Northwest Hospital trip because it was at the end of the day, of course. And just wanted to make an appointment for her, and there were some transportation issues, and so I just wanted her to get a needle in her shoulder right then. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, so what now? So usually with septic arthritis, they have to do multiple joint aspirations. They have to give 2 weeks of IV antibiotics and then oral antibiotics for the next 2 or 3 weeks. And so we're just going to keep on. I'm going to call her today and see how her visit went last Saturday. And then if she hasn't had a first office call with patient care, make sure she does that. Review her past medical records and just follow up. So definitely want to make sure that if it is septic arthritis, that it's taken care of. Or if it's not, figure out what's going on, because that's our whole thing, like the cause. Any other questions?